We are in paper 37, section 9. We got a ways into this section. I'll tell you in a second. But section 9, in the single column, old single column, that's page 415. Okay, it's the subsection there in section 9 about the midway creatures. That's the seventh paragraph, or if you have a version that numbers list items as, you know, in a paragraph as separate paragraphs, that would be 11. But the easy way to find it is just scan the italic, you know, subheadings there and see the midway creatures. About midway through the section. And let's just remind ourselves a little bit, since we're right in the middle of a section, what they're doing with this section. You know, if you look to the beginning of the section, you know, that list I was just referring to. So we have these permanent citizens of the local universe, as they're labeling this, and they give us four different variations on that theme: the Susatia, the Univitatia, the Material Suns, and the Midway creatures. So the main thing that you notice right away that's happening as you go down that list, 1, 2, 3, 4, is you're going from the local universe headquarters level with the Susatia down to the constellation level with the Univitatia, down another notch to the local system level with the Material Suns, and then, you know, even though those are the three levels of the local universe proper, you know, you do effectively have another notch down, a world itself. You know, so down that fourth notch is going down to an actual inhabited world, and having midway creatures. And, you know, there's a lot more about the midway creatures in other places. We'll be getting to one of those shortly when we get to the next paper, the end of the next paper. But they give us an introduction to them here. As we've seen a number of times, they're trying to make sure that before we get lost in the details of a creature, a particular type of creature, we appreciate how they fit into the cosmic system. So, you know, you have, a holistic recognition of them. They aren't all disembodied from the cosmic system and just an endless proliferation of, well, there's these beings and these beings and who can keep it all straight. You know, to see it in a systematic way so that they fit in somewhere, and then they can help to foster that holistic, systemic recognition of the cosmic system that you're a part of, unrecognized until the fifth epical revelation. Now, they're desiring that we challenge ourselves to see ourselves as a member of the cosmic system and not just, you know, a bunch of creatures, at best children of God, wandering around in the darkness on some material orb, right? To really see beyond that, to recognize that the truth of where you stand on this world is not expressed by a designation like the Earth, you know, the dirt ball. Thinking of it that factually and simplistically, literally, you know, a ball of Earth. You live on a place in that cosmic system, a place in the heavens, your rancha, your heavenly place, your place in the heavens, your place in the cosmos. When you see permanent citizens of the local universe, that's in contrast to you, a cosmic citizen of a different flavor. An ascending citizen, or at least you're moving towards being officially designated as that when you fuse. All right, so that's the point. And then just the one other little detail besides the hierarchy of going down 1, 2, 3, 4. Remember that we noticed that there was actually two things on that top level, that unity level in the local universe, at the local universe headquarters. You didn't just have Susatia. They were paired up with the spirit-fused mortals, as you recall. Because you have a definitive level of perfection, you know, at that universe ceiling. That represents a specific measure of perfection. And so the Susatia are created perfect. See, in that relative sense, relative to the top of the local universe, the Susatia are the perfect beings. And the spirit-fused mortals are their complementary pairs, the perfected. You know, when they get there, they're inducted into the Nebadon core of, you know, perfection. Of perfection, not completion. The first step is the Nebadon core of perfection. Then they have that long process of penetrating, you know, to embrace the fullness of the whole local universe, and then it's the Nebadon core of completion. Right. Yep.
Are the Susatia at the same level of perfection as the Havona citizens?
No, that was the whole point of, you know, I was just saying there, to begin to think of a relativity of perfection.
Gotcha.
Historically, that's a complete non sequitur. You know, what humans have thought about, you know, relativity at the same time they were thinking about perfection. You know, and that's part of the problem. You know, our tendency to absolutize everything, you know, and take everything completely out of context of the domain we live in. You know, your first step is far removed from anything that should be using the absolute adjective in front of it. You've got a lot of work to do. But to recognize that there, you are properly, you know, labeled perfect, you know, in a certain way when you get to Salvington, graduate from Salvington. You leave there local universe-wise perfected. And then you're going to work through super universe-wise perfected, et cetera. Working up the perfection ladder until you have a full finite perfectness. And then you'll work on that full finite completeness. Okay. I was stressing that because we'll see another example of that coming up here in a little bit once we're done with the midway creatures. Okay. So let's get going here.
The midway creatures. In the early days of most inhabited worlds, certain superhuman but materialized beings are of assignment, but they usually retire upon the arrival of the planetary atoms. The transactions of such beings and the efforts of the material suns to improve the evolutionary races often result in the appearance of a limited number of creatures who are difficult to classify. These unique beings are often midway between the material suns and the evolutionary creatures, hence their designation, midway creatures. In a comparative sense, these midwayers are the permanent citizens of the evolutionary worlds. From the early days of the arrival of a planetary prince to the far distant time of the settling of the planet enlightened life, they are the only group of intelligent beings to remain continuously on the sphere. On Urantia, the midway ministers are in reality the actual custodians of the planet. They are, practically speaking, the citizens of Urantia. Mortals are indeed the physical and material inhabitants of an evolutionary world, but you are also short-lived. You tarry on your native planet such a short time. You were born, live, die, and pass on to the other worlds of evolutionary progression. Even the superhuman beings who serve on the planets as celestial ministers are of transient assignment. Few of them are long attached to a given sphere. The midway creatures, however, provide continuity of planetary administration in the face of ever-changing celestial ministries and constantly shifting mortal inhabitants. Throughout all of this never ceasing, changing, and shifting, the Midway creatures remain on the planet uninterruptedly, carrying on their work.
Okay, and the very paragraph to describe them here is done in the spirit of a Midway creature. As you know, when a Midway creature writes things, he loves big paragraphs. Yeah, it's amazing. It's all not all one sentence, right? I mean, they love to see how masterly they construct a gigantic single sentence, that isn't overwrought. So just notice that this great big huge. They didn't break it up into two paragraphs. That's a little tip of the hat to the Midwayers, just right there. Just to point out one little thing, that you misread there, just to stress it, when they said your nativity planet, and you read your native planet. See, just think about that contrast. That's part of the contrast they're actually trying to get at. This is, pretty much in quotes, our native planet, but it is our nativity planet. It's more the native planet for the natives, the Midwayers, okay? Right? We're just born here and off we go. Right. That's the fact that contrast came up there was helpful. You notice how kind of superficially they're engaging us. I mean, they're not even directly speaking to primary, secondary, midway, or contrast, or anything like that yet. They didn't even explain specifically who they were talking about when they said, in the early days of most inhabited worlds, certain superhuman but materialized beings are of assignment. Okay, who are we talking about? We're talking about the prince's staff, right, who were Marantia beings, senders, in our case, on Gerasim, and then were given material bodies that Marantia form was then associated with. So that's the materialized part of that. Okay, so we're talking about the prince's staff, corporeal staff, and the planetary atoms. And we all know that from both of those came a set of midwayers. From the prince's staff, the primary midwayers, that significant Marantia energy giving rise to the higher nature of those beings. And then the secondaries of lesser nature relative to the primaries, because they're just coming more directly from the Adamites. But it's none of the details here. We'll get to that later. But, because they're in that mode, when they say these unique beings are often midway between the material suns and the evolutionary creatures, okay, often meaning the secondaries are very much in that mode. I mean, a primary midwayer, you wouldn't think of them as being somehow like in between a material sun and a mortal, very much in that material creature space. But a secondary you can think of as being downstepped from the immediate Adamic like stock and upstepped from the human like stock, then it's being in between. So, the secondaries are very much midway in that sense. The primaries are more angel like in nature, right? Less human-like in nature. Okay. Because of that, the primaries have more of a positive-negative duality like angels, as opposed to a female, male, male-female duality, essentially the secondary midwayers do. I mean, they're not reproducing, but they do have they have a duality, and it's more of a male-female like that we understand kind of a duality, like material sons and daughters and mortals, that they're in between. Right? There was a question somewhere,
So they must be very material-like in nature, then.
Right, so except for this...
Well, we can't see them.
Except for this energization that makes it so that we, you know, unless they choose, they're not visible. But if they make themselves visible, they're very much, you know, just like this. So that's what's so fascinating about them, you know, that if one was sitting here, you could examine him and it would just be like a human, you know, with all the organs and, you know, skin and everything, you know, and just, it would, you know, but then they can somehow dial that knob, internal knob within themselves and make it so that substance is no longer interacting with photons or my hand or whatnot. You know, that's some really interesting physics that would be very fun to understand. But, you know, it's not like they make them, if they're visible, they're some sort of, you know, like tink, tink, tink or something. There's some sort of weird artificial tin man or something, you know, that is in front of you. I mean, they're just completely corporeal, flesh and blood, just like you. With, you know, a heart that's pumping blood through veins and all this sort of stuff. I mean, they're just the grandchildren of Adamson and Rada. Yeah.
Go play catch with them.
So, you know, it's just that they're a very definitive reminder of how little we understand exactly what this matter is. We think of it in very simplistic ways. It's obviously nowhere near as simplistic as we think it is.
Yeah. Can you give us some specific times when they have made themselves material and are recorded?
Well, there was that one just behind you 2 seconds ago, but you missed it.
I'm trying to give an example. He knew what you were going to talk about.
Now, okay, I mean, for those of you on the webinar, he's asking about, you know, is there some specific times that secondaries made themselves visible? Well, you know, the interesting thing is they don't have to make themselves visible in order to do material things. They see, not only do they have this very interesting energy nature that we don't understand, but they have an interface, like a power being, to non-living material things. You know, and so they can roll away the stone, you know, of Jesus' tomb.
Out of jail or something like that?
What was that?
Did they peter out of jail?
Right, right. There's, you know, there's the things about, you know,
and they have something with animals
letting people. Right, right. I mean, there's all these things, you know, that they can do.
They can control animals, right?
Right. Well, I mean, their mind, because their mind is, you know, not that different from ours, they can very easily interface, you know, with the mind of an animal. So, you know, back when there were rebel secondaries, many strange things happened in those days, remember? You know, like, you know, if they got bored, they could just play games with animals, you know, or whatever. So, you know, you can imagine, you know, that it's not surprising that, you know, that ancient mortals had all kinds of curious mythologies that they built up and stuff. I mean, the things that were going on around them were, yeah, pretty amazing from our current perspective.
So what from the revelation makes you think they have a heart?
Well, okay, so the whole thing is just to recognize that...
I don't mean a heart, soul part. I mean a heart...
I know what you mean. I know what you mean. Okay, why do I think that they're literally, you know, like this? I mean, because it's, you know, it's an actual biologic process, as they describe, that gets you. I mean... You know, so you have Adamson and Rada, you know, and every fourth child is one of the progenitors of the secondary midwares. I mean, that child is not some sort of a weird thing that doesn't have internal organs or something like that. I mean, it's literally, you know, a phenomenon. You know, it's their DNA that came together, and a sperm cell and an egg cell, and there was a conception, and it was, you know, it matured and... in Rada's womb and was born, you know, everything. You know, and they say, you know, you had male and female ones of those, and they made it. They had literal just biologic offspring. Again, it's a genetic phenomenon. It, you know,
a different substance because they last for so long.
Well, see, again, see, that's the thing to recognize. It's the same substance plus something else. That's what's going on, right? I mean, you have... Well, it's not like that. I mean, the way it works there in terms of them not dying, you know, or aging. I mean, so what's going on is you have all of the material nature that we understand, plus there's some additional. So in other words, there's energy that's very much material-like that's sort of a direct extension of this. You know, but I don't quite know what I'm talking about when I'm saying that. But it... You know, and so they have this range to their energy form. I mean, it's not unlike when they just tell you, you know, that you have Morantia substance. Okay, it's not like it's some totally different thing. It's literally the material atoms that we know, like the oxygen atoms I'm breathing in, you know, I'm respirating right now. It's literally like those oxygen atoms with some spirit energy added to it. So it's everything that was there before in terms of that oxygen atom, it's electrons and everything, but with spirit energy combined with it, so now you have a Morantia oxygen atom. You know, and so their bodies are a similar thing. I mean, it's all of the material that we understand that would come about by a genetic, you know, procreation process, but more to it. Somehow, something added to it, okay? And not magical things like humans dream up, like dark matter or stuff like that, you know? Right? I mean, it's just, you know, it's something real, okay? You know, and the point basically to begin to understand is you, in a very crude sense, you have two substances, material substance on one end and spirit substance on the other end of a spectrum, where initially you just think the only thing that connects those two substances together is mind energy. Okay, but that's a simplistic initial perspective that they give you. Technically, there's a whole spectrum of substance. Okay, and it's much more complicated than just a linear spectrum. It's a multi-dimensional spectrum, where, you know, there's a whole region of substances that are not too far removed from just what we know as just material substance. So there's sort of all that material substance plus some additional. There's, you know, there's a region where it's pure spirit substance, and then there's, you know, centered around, you know, about that center, there's substances that are kind of like that pure spirit, but not quite. And then just fill it out and recognize that it, you know, it shades all the way from one to the other.
Could it be kind of like, you know, water when it's a thin vapor, you can't see it, but it's there. But when it's a thick, you know, it's water. You can feel and touch it, but it's, in a way, it's a way of describing how the molecules or how the same elements can be there but not appear to be there, so to speak?
Well, what you have to reflect on is how you know there's matter in the first place. I mean, why is it, you know, my hand, you know, meets something, some sort of resistance when I put it down on the arm of this couch?
I read that this morning. You know,
I mean, you know, it's because there's a like-to-like interaction that's going on. I mean, you know, I could be just as solid, but if I wasn't like this, my hand would pass through it. I mean, you have, there has to be a means of interacting. Right? See, so, you know, literally, if the midway or secondary midway is standing in front of me, he's all just as solidly there. He's not ethereal. He's not like, you know, lots of holes in him or something, so he's misty or something. He's completely solid. It's just that the photons or my hand or any sort of a molecular atomic thing does not interact with that, and so it's as if it's not there. Okay, the photons, instead of getting absorbed by that body, you know, like that light over there, you know, if his body is here, I couldn't see that light because those photons would get absorbed by the back of his head. Okay,
is there anything in there?
But instead, they just go right through.
That might be analogous.
Yeah, there is the thing that makes this quite immediately understandable that we discovered back in the 20th century in physics is neutrinos. Okay, every second, there are, you know, more neutrinos than you can imagine passing through your fingernail. Okay? You know, electron neutrinos. And, you know, it's as if your finger is not there. They just pass right through. You don't see them, you don't feel them, you know, but there's gazillions of them every second passing through. You know, they pass right through the Earth as if it's not there because they don't interact.
So
Okay? So it's like they're, you know, they're not made out of physical energy, but they're just as much physical energy as an electron.
Kind of like when I hit a golf ball in the trees and they say, oh,
we're
90% air.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, but that was expensive air. when they package it like that, you have to pay for that air. Okay. But you see, you know, just to recognize that, you know, that a neutrino, an electron neutrino, and an electron are very, very similar in terms of their physical energy. But they have no means of easily interacting with each other. The neutrino doesn't have mass. The electron does, so they can't interact mass-wise. The electron has charge. The electron neutrino doesn't, so they can't interact charge-wise. But they have just as many automatons. They both have 100 automatons, you know. And so, you know, but see, they just pass right past each other without interacting.
Is that because?
Because there's just nothing immediate. Right?
Is it also because their purpose differently?
Well, you could say in a bigger sense that their purpose differently. They're.
It's not because they don't touch each other necessarily. Because there's so much space at that level.
I mean,
between them.
You know, if you get them spot on lined up. Okay, you know, the two collections of 100 automatons will, you know, plow into each other and they'll interact. Okay, but you got to get them lined up just perfectly, and they're really, really tiny. Okay, so, I mean, it doesn't happen very often. Most of the time, you know, they're just a little bit off and they just go right past each other. See, I mean, normally when things interact, it's not because they're hitting, you know, spot on, you know, butting against each other. It's just that the way they're interacting is extended. You know, like if I'm interacting, you know, through an electric field, I can be a long ways away from something and be interacting with it electrically. That's why, you know, it's a very large cross section. See, when you've got one of these extended interacting mechanisms, but if you don't have that, then you know the only way they're going to interact. See, and every once in a while, an electron neutrino will interact with your fingernail. But it's very, very infrequent because it's got to hit one of those particles just square on. So it's a very, very low probability event. Okay, because there's no extended interaction mechanism. Okay, so it's the same thing. You know, you know, like you're just talking about the golf ball. You know that if I zero in, zoom in on my finger, my hand, it's mostly air. It's mostly not hand. Right? I mean, on a microscopic scale. So there's plenty of room for my my atoms to pass through the midwayer's atoms. You know, they're just two ships that pass in the night. My hand is passing through his body if he's standing right here. It's not like it's not, it's just that they're not interacting. Okay, and neither is the photon. That's, you know, it's just, right. It's going right through all the cracks. Right, because there's no interaction, so he can't feel it.
The interesting thing is, it kind of like the Melchizedek's, where he has a switch that he could.
Right, so that he can, you know, he can
interact.
He can, right, see, he can make it so that, right, see, and that's just very mysterious. What exactly is he doing? See?
Hope he doesn't turn on while your hand's in the middle of his.
Right. Right, now, you know, he's going to make sure he doesn't do that too, right? You know, otherwise I'll, you know, rip his intestines. You know, my hand's passing through, right? I mean, so yeah, right. It's that literal. You want to think of it? It's literal. It's just it has this additional variability that we have no concept of. No, I mean, there's no indication that they can do like the Melchizedek's, you know. I mean, so if he makes himself visible, he's going to look like the grandchild of Adams and Rada. Okay, he's going to look like a beautiful human specimen, because that's what he is. Okay. Someone else, here, yeah.
Well, the dark gravity bodies are supposed to not be reactive to light.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, how do they, if they don't, how do they act as a curtain? Where we can't see
anything. Well, see, you know, remember, a lot of that stuff is kind of in quotes. I mean, you know, you're talking about material substance with the central universe, including the dark gravity body, that's going transcendent of the finite. So, you know, in many ways, technically what's going on, you know, you can only see on a finite level, and that stuff is above you. So you just, you know, quote unquote above you. So you're just, you know, you're looking underneath it, quote unquote, see? I mean, it's not sort of down there in the finite. But, you know, see, those statements are just fraught with all sorts of, you know, confusing things, just like when we're trying to think about the secondary midware. Because, see, somehow those dark gravity bodies are downstepping the absolute of the aisle down into the finite, so that the finite universe, as we can observe it, you know, is broken up into levels and all this sort of stuff. I mean, so exactly, you know, how does that interface work? I don't know. Okay. But
which one is it that's 1111 bit, primary or secondary?
Secondaries. Secondary. Right. The remaining secondaries are 1111 of them, yep. Started out with 1984 of them. Okay, so, all right. Yeah, you notice we just couldn't resist going into all the things that aren't immediately in front of us here. But
fascinating.
But you're right, it's very fascinating. But you know, let's not lose sight of their role in this immediate system that we're seeing. That there's something very natural and complete about there being an essentially permanent citizen on all of these levels. And the fact that there's these beings that show up down on the inhabited world level is fraught with some mystery. The cessation, the univitation, the material sons and daughters are very much part of this coming down, you know, ultimately from existential deity expression of things, and you're just getting a more and more downstepped expression till finally you reach sort of the lowest levels that can be expressed from the top down like that. But then parallel to that, related to experiential deity, you know, as the, you know, the remote source of this phenomenon as opposed to existential deity, you have an upwelling rather than a downwelling phenomenon of, you know, in a way that doesn't have anything to do with very definitive creator beings coming together and making another being, you know, in this downstepping mode. There's no observable creator at all, and through the mix of what's going on with the lower beings, these beings come into existence. They're, you know, it's fundamentally the mystery of them is related to the mystery of the Supreme. You know, that these are indirect, from our perspective, creations of the Supreme Being. You know, down in, you know, who's a transcendental being, you know. But that's being manifested down in the finite, so there's no obvious person you can point to that does some sort of creative act and then boom, there's a primary midware. It comes, it coalesces out of the system, you know, and they never know quite how it's going to happen and whatnot, because the Supreme is just not totally predictable. We've talked about that quite a bit here recently. Right? So you end up with, you know, when we get to the next paper and we talk more about the angels, or that whole hierarchy of angelic-like beings, you have this down from the top spectrum of beings, and then parallel to them, coming up out of the supremacy, you know, are these midwares and probably all kinds of other beings they don't reveal, right? You know, and so that you have secondary midwares and a certain flavor of angel that are kind of at the same eye level, you know, in the vertical hierarchy, and then primary midwayer is at the same level as a certain kind of angel in the hierarchy, you know, and probably a whole bunch of other beings that are parallel on the other side, you know, to higher beings. Yeah.
Well, they do say that as you progress into light and life, and they adjust your vision. So that you were able to perceive these beings later on as we, as right. the planet progresses.
Right.
They're able to adjust our
right. Right.
senses, so to speak.
Right.
So they can't be that far off.
Right. So yeah. Right. Yeah. And you know, both the secondary midwares and those that lowest order of angels that they're not allowed to talk about, you know, very much. See, both of them are just as close as you can be to us without actually being the same energy body as us. They're just immediately outside of our ability to have a way to experience them with some sort of an interactive mechanism. Okay. And that brings in this whole thing about, you know, what's going on with, take a material son and daughter, being able to see a lot of, not just, you know, midwares, but some of the lower orders of spirit beings and things. Okay, I mean, and they've got basically my kind of eyeballs, and those eyeballs use the whole photon thing coming from light sources, and but that doesn't interact with, you know, the body of a seraphim.
But even Jesus.
In any. Right, so it brings in this whole issue of, you know, does this involve like other radiant sources? I mean, they certainly talk about how there's all kinds of different luminosities, you know, irradiating, you know, the universe, lighting it. So right, there's all kinds of mysteries. See how exactly this works, what's going on, but it all has to have some literalness. That our way of seeing is analogous to our way of seeing is some sort of a downstepped expression of all higher ways of seeing. One day, not too far in the future, we'll understand that a lot better. Exactly what's going on there. You know, again, the important thing, you know, when you start really trying to understand how you see anything, you know, is to begin to appreciate you don't see anything as a material fact. I mean, what you see is totally in the mind. I mean, you're conscious of a form in the mind. And there's the mystery of how a form got put into the mind that represents what's going on in the material world. You don't actually see the material world. That's impossible. Mind energy and material energy, are not overlapping. Once it really sinks in that what you're always seeing, hearing, touching, tasting, whatnot, is in your mind and not material, taking that next step of thinking about other senses and things like this, you know, you begin to appreciate that there's all kinds of opportunity for other senses, because you know your mind has a lot of potential that can't even begin to express at this lowly level. So you get up a little higher, and you know that more directly the mind is involved in the senses. Less and less do you need the intermediary things like, you know, jiggling eardrum gizmos and stuff like that. Adam and Eve still need some fancier gizmo things, you know, you remember the little gas chamber thing and stuff. Okay, but you get up higher and it can be done more directly without those sorts of mechanisms involved. And, you know, I talk to you just directly mindily, you know, when I'm on Gerasim talking to you, and stuff like that, right? So, so that's... Remember that, and that's why, you know, way back when I first started it, so I was trying to get to that point to appreciate, you know, that initially we think that all that's in between some very point-like matter substance and some point-like spirit substance, you know, and there's nothing in between that's substance and it's just mind energy that's linking them. Well, technically there are substances that you don't have access to as a finite phenomenon that do fill that gap, that are parallel to that mind. And so the more you have a significant mind phenomenon going on, the more you could have a relationship to that intermediary space of substance, okay, and you could see something that isn't just all the way at the material endpoint, okay, because you've basically made it so that you, right now you have a mind that really is only associated with that very remote endpoint of the energy spectrum, but a higher mind relates to a little bit more of it, and more of it until you have a mind that actually can, you know, relate to the whole spectrum from what we think of as an endpoint of matter and an endpoint of spirit. So that's what's going on with that. Okay. Let's see here. This gigantic paragraph. Are there some important things that I've now forgotten completely that we don't want to skip over? Let's see. Let's see here. Right, the whole bit about their permanent citizens. Let's see here. Anything else? That last little bit. The midway creatures, however, provide continuity of planetary administration in the face of ever-changing celestial ministries. Now, that's an important point they're stressing right here. That they never know exactly, especially secondary midwives, not only when, but how many there's going to be. But they always find that when all is said and done, the number of secondary midwives that coincidentally come into existence, you know, that supreme thing, that coincidentally thing, is just what you need for that particular world. You know, and you're reminding this. See, there's some very definitive roles that have to be filled, and coincidentally the Supreme fills them one way or another. And so that brings in that whole question, well, what if there's a rebellion like we had? And what if you lost the, you know, primaries and secondary midwares? How do you fill that void? It's not an arbitrary thing. So, you know, there's jobs that must be done. It can't be just done by any old being. You know, who steps in? Someone has to step in and fill those deficits, you know, 4/5 of the primary midwares, and, you know, et cetera. So, you know, you want to keep that in mind, like we're stressing. You have a cosmic system, you know, and it's perfectly efficient. You don't have superfluous beings, and you're not missing any beings, you know. So if you take some of them off the chessboard because of rebellion, something shifts in the whole system that, you know, that makes up for that. What special things are going on here that wouldn't go on a world that hadn't lost its indispensable midwares? Something has to have, you know, been brought into play to fill that gap.
And so, they say there's 50,000 of them normally on a planet?
50,000 primaries, yeah. Yeah.
Now we have hardly any.
Right, yeah. Like I said, we lost 4/5 of them, roughly. Yeah, 40,000 of them, yeah, roughly.
10,000 left?
Yeah, of primaries.
Primaries. Yeah. So you're saying that something...
So, yeah, someone's got to be filling in all of that, you know, all that gap. I'm stressing that because it's an important thing to keep in the back of your mind as you're trying to understand how the system works that you live in, you know, that it... you know, when all is said and done, there'll be nothing random about how many mortals, you know, were born between the beginning and the end on this planet, for instance. You know, you get to the grand universe settled in light and life, and you look back, it's like, huh, look at that. Exactly the number that you needed to make the grand universe complete just happened to be born through that incredibly seemingly random process that was going on in Urantia. Not one fewer, not one more. Everything has a spot on, you know, to the digit, you know, specificity to it, you know, and that's a universe that mankind is not used to thinking of, you know, that has that level of precision, you know, everyone will be delighted when they can look back, you know, and see all of that, how marvelously it was orchestrated by the whole. You know, why does it have that kind of, because the universal mother, you know, makes it a whole. And That's why in the end there are no coincidences. Every point is touched, independent of space, independent of time, at the end from the beginning, you know, it will work like a system.
Sure not.
Yeah. Right down to the, you know, not one extra automaton, you know, in the grand universe will there be. So, you know, that level of precision, you know, is just not immediately comprehensible to mankind. All right. And then, of course, there's a little reminder that, you know, don't overblow the significance of your life as they dismiss you, you know. There. I mean, you know, you guys are just like, you know, here today, gone tomorrow. They're trying to inject a little humility in there, too, in passing, yes. You know, but you are also short-lived. You know, we're like fruit flies to them, you know, in terms of, you know, you're here today and gone tomorrow. And you're born, live, and die. Poof. So, you know, keep that in perspective. Yeah. All right, let's read some more here.
In like manner, all divisions of the administrative organization of the local universes and super universes have their more or less permanent populations, inhabitants of citizenship status. As Urantia has its midwares, Gerasim, your system capital, has the material sons and daughters. Edentia, your constellation headquarters, has the Univitatia, while the citizens of Salvicton are twofold, the created Susatia and the evolving spirit-fused, evolved spirit-fused mortals. The administrative worlds of the minor and major sectors of the superuniverses do not have permanent citizens, but the Uversa headquarters spheres are continuously fostered by an amazing group of beings known as the Abaddonters, the creation of the unrevealed agents of the agents of Ancients of Days and the seven reflective spirits resident on the capital of Orvinton. These residential citizens on Uversa are at present administering the routine affairs of their world under the immediate supervision of the Uversa core of the sun-fused mortals. Even Havona has its native beings, and the central isle of light and life is the home of the various groups of paradise citizens.
And just with that last thing, don't forget that this world is giving rise to countless numbers of individuals who will become permanent paradise citizens. You know, all the children that get resurrected in the probationary nursery, send all the way to paradise. And just like you have spirit-fused mortals, you know, just ascending to the local universe headquarters and then becoming permanent citizens of the local universe, or these sun-fused mortals, they just remind you of ascending all the way to the super universe headquarters and then becoming permanent citizens of the super universe. All of those children, you know, that are resurrected in the probationary nursery, the father's salvaged children, you know, ascend to the father and become permanent citizens of the isle. Well, no, I mean they go ahead and fuse with an adjuster and everything, but you know, but they don't go into the core of the finality. You know, they go into becoming permanent citizens of the Isle of Paradise. You know, as father fused mortals. Okay, so
it's a bad place to be.
Right, right. It's just, you know, again, it just reminds you. I mean, there's no way they can have a complete experience on the lower level, so it's just a technical thing that they can't be a finaliter. A finaliter are those beings that embody the whole spectrum. These are beings that don't, and it's, you know, and then all when all is said and done, you know, you're going to recognize that they're an indispensable being, you know, that the universe could not function unless, you know, that child that didn't, you know, get born materially, say, you know, and was resurrected on a probationary nursery and ended up being that permanent citizen, unless that happened, the universe couldn't work. And there's nothing accidental about all this stuff, you know, and again, when all is said and done, you know, there'll be exactly the number of those permanent paradise citizens that there must be. And it seemed to have come about by completely random, ignorant processes and stuff. No, there's nothing. You know, it's all a cosmic system. And you know, so, yeah, they're trying to get us to think in that system terms, where everything has its place. All you have to do is just let go of your circumscribed view of it temporally and spatially, and then it all becomes an eternal whole.
Yeah. What's interesting in that is that, you know, you mentioned earlier that, you know, you live, die, and are born in it.
Yeah.
And but that first little flicker of instant, you know, life, is that important that you don't become a finality?
Well, but again, it's, you know, it's that significant, it's that relevant.
Yeah.
I mean, being a finaler is not an arbitrary definition.
I'm just saying it's interesting that this first life
right.
has that much.
If it didn't have that much significance,
yeah.
this life wouldn't exist. If it didn't, you know, make a difference in eternity, the lowliest of time wouldn't exist. The only reason anything exists is because it is relevant in eternity, right? So,
I know,
and it's important to let that sink in. I mean, because again, you know, what's behind all of this? Something that knows not time, right? Knows not the difference between potential and actual. Does the Father know the difference between a potential human and an actual human? No, there's no difference in eternity. Those words don't exist. The words potential and actual don't exist in eternity. Right? So when, you know, when humans get all bottled up in time, you know, and think there's something eternally significant about the difference between a potentiality and an actuality, that's illogical. Okay? You can't think like that. Now, there is no difference. These things that, you know, all of these thoughts of really getting the idea of eternity into your viewpoint, definitively, getting the idea of a cosmic system into your viewpoint definitively. If you do that, you're going to change. It changes the way you think about everything that you've ever done or will do. Okay, I mean, that's what you're trying to do. You're trying to make it so that nothing is as what you thought it was. You're trying to be revealed to. You're trying to have everything change. Every way you've thought about, you know, birth, death, you know, life and death, and everything in between. You want it all to change, what it all means. Okay, now here's a fun little sidelight. So just as we saw, like I emphasized, that you have a perfect and a perfected, you know, and that's why it's evolved, not evolving, because it's perfected, right? Just like you had a perfect and a perfected pair for a universe, it's that much of a one turning, a completeness that it has its own definition of perfection associated with it. So there's a perfect and a perfected pair of the Sucetia and the spirit-fused mortals. At the super-universe level, you have the Abandonters and the sun-fused mortals. And you know the sun-fused mortals are a relatively speaking, a limited number. Okay, so you wonder. It's like, well, are the Abandonters also, relatively limited in numbers like that? We're not sure. You do notice an interesting thing that they mention here, that the Abandonters are under the immediate supervision of the sun-fused mortals. Okay, so why is that? Okay, so in other words, these ascended mortals, sun-fused mortals, have some sort of a vantage point that's above beings that come into existence seemingly at a pretty high level. Where have we seen that before? Remember the creature trinitized sons? Okay, those beings are coming into existence at a very high level. You know, say two finaliters or a finaliter and a and a paradise a citizen or something like that. I mean, that's a very, but they are kind of awkward in the finite. When you give rise to beings at very high levels, in many ways they're mostly transfinite. And their finite shadow that you can interact with, you know, the finite expression that you can interact with as a finite being is awkward. It's very incomplete, very limited. It needs supervision by something that's more definitively in the finite. Right? See, so that's what you've got going on there. Okay, now think about those two parents. This is the other spot that the unrevealed beings are mentioned. Right? Those unrevealed, okay, who are those? Remember, we saw them back in the paper 30. When you look on the psychic circles in the sevenfold chart, so you can see all the hierarchy of mothers, cosmic mothers. Okay, here's the reflective mother spirits, you know, of the master spirits. Okay, and there's that other level. At the collective super universe level, you have a womb, a mother presence, the creative mother agencies of the ancients of days. Okay, those mothers are located on the super universe headquarters, but they are not providing a womb of mind for just that super universe. The ones on all seven are working together as a collective womb for the whole collective seven super universes. Okay, there are beings there. Okay, and they apparently had permission to tell us something that those beings do besides what you can expect, that they supply mind for, say, when you're a finaliter and things like that. Those beings get together with those beings. The reflective mother spirits and the creative mother agencies pair up and make Abaddonners. Okay. Well, the reflective mother spirits are high enough, but the creative mother agencies are even higher. Okay. So, are those children going to be ceiling dwellers and a little awkward in the finite? Yeah, they're most likely going to be. They're up there like those, you know, those creature trinitized sons, where they're just, you know, you get a super additive consequence from those two mothers coming together, and you know you're mostly going super finite in that super additive consequence. But apparently, they're quite fascinating beings. See, an amazing group of beings. And you can just imagine if the two parents are both, you know, very definitively a mother-like presence, they must have some really significant sort of ubiquity-like nature or something or manifestation or something. You know, you don't know exactly what, but you're thinking we know how significant just the offspring of the reflective mother spirits are, this Sakonafim, you know, with their reflectivity ability and stuff, where they're not so just localized. They have a consciousness that's more, you know, ubiquitous and do lots of amazing things. Right. So what happens when you do that on steroids, right, in some way here, with adding in the creative mother agencies of the ancients of days? These are apparently very interesting beings, but probably won't get to really appreciate what their purposing is. So, I mean, I think it was you brought up purposing a while back, what their real definitive purposing is until the next universe age, until we get to the Absinite age. And, you know, you just like the, you know, creature trinitized sons, and you'll finally, oh, wow, now I'm seeing what they were foreshadowing, you know. All right, so that's a That's a fun little tidbit there about the Avendotters, and you know, and that, you know, that just one additional little reference to the creative mother agencies of the ancients of days. Yep.
Why Avendotter and Eggendotter are so closely?
I can't explain because I haven't figured out the etymology of either of them.
It's
just
so a letter different.
Yeah, they're so similar, and I don't know what that's indicating. I've got to figure out some more
and
of these someday.
They act solo also, but
you're really suspicious that you know that similarity is not just a coincidence; that it's somehow is telling you something, right? So, you know, most likely, if you could figure them out. You know, you would learn something about both of those groups at the same time, you know, if they're associated like that. I mean, the first thing you can just, you know, suspect is, you know, what you were just saying about what they say about Agendanters, you know, and their, the significance that they play in, you know, with their uniqueness in the system. You know, all the way, you know, on finaliters and everything. So, you know, we all know as finaliters, we are definitely playing with the end of the finite age while we're still in the finite age. You know, we're definitely in relationship to what's to come a lot. And these beings are, like I was saying, are obviously, you know, way up there. In the end stages of the finite, so see, they may be suggesting something about those two being, you know, hand in glove in some way. Yep. You know, but if we work with them in some way as finaliters, I'm sure they couldn't reveal that. But see, you might, you know, get suspicious about it if you can figure it out a little bit more. Okay. All right. So there we have it. And then we've got this last section here. Give us some, by and large, everything else can't be revealed, but there's a couple exceptions that they fill in for us. Because they need them in order to have a complete story. You know, we all know, especially Spornaja, there's a number of things they couldn't make understandable to you if they didn't have them as characters in this play that they're laying out for you. So they've got to be introduced. So let's...
Spornaja.
The ones I was saying that you definitely know a lot about. But okay.
Section 10, other local universe groups. Besides the seraphic and mortal orders, who will be considered in later papers, there are numerous additional beings concerned in the maintenance and perfecting of such a gigantic organization as the universe of Nebadon, which even now has more than 3 million inhabited worlds, with 10 million in prospect. The various Nebadon types of life are much too numerous to be cataloged in this paper, but there are two unusual orders that function extensively on the 647,591 architectural spheres of the local universe that may be mentioned.
All right, so that's pretty straightforward. Let's just remind yourself, you may have forgotten back, you know, in the first paper, towards the beginning of the first paper in this part of the book, they gave you the exact number of inhabited planets, at least at, you know, the time they were looking at the registry. 3,840,101. So, you know, the more than 3 million is, yeah, it's quite, you know, significantly. It's almost 4 million.
So that's in our super universe. In our local universe.
Yeah, in our local universe.
So we have less than half of
the right. Right. We're very young yet. You know, that's why there's still such intense energy activities going on in some quarters of Nebadon and stuff that the power beings have to work with so aggressively, because there's so much raw material still afoot that, you know, that hasn't gotten collected. And so the very active region. And then, you know, in case you you know, are wondering, the 647,591 it's significant that they actually state that directly. If you do a little quick math, you know, that's just the you've got 10,000 local systems. And let's do a little quiz here. How many architectural worlds, you know, does it appear from what we know are in one local system? You know, like if you go to Gerasim, how many architectural worlds are there?
50.
Okay, you've got
seven.
You've got seven primary satellites, right? And each primary satellite has how many sub-satellites?
Seven.
It's 49. So, no. 49 sub-satellites.
56.
Right, right.
Oh, plus seven more, so it's 56.
56 plus the central, you know, 57. Right. See, so there's, so, you know, 10,000 57s, right? And then there's 100 constellations. How many worlds are, you know, does it, you know, they tell you are in a constellation headquarters system with this, you know, the central world, the satellites, and the sub-satellites. You've got 70 primaries. Yep, 70 primaries, and how many secondaries are around each primary?
10.
All right, so there's 771 in each constellation.
Times 100.
Times 100. And then how many are at the super universe capital? Remember how many are? 491, counting, you know, the central one. All right, see, so if you just, you know, add all those together, you'll get this. It's like, okay, so there aren't any variations. It's every single local system constellation is exactly the same.
So all the architectural spheres are built, even though the planets aren't.
Yeah, remember though, with the constellation and the local universe worlds are built, you know, right away.
Right.
The local system worlds are spread out over time. You know,
but all local systems must be operating at.
All local systems are in place. There's a headquarters built, if I'm remembering, isn't it 5 billion years ago they said they built the last local system headquarters? You know, so for several billion years now, you know, you've had all of them in place.
They just don't have all their planets.
But, you know, I mean, some, you know, one of those, you know, maybe they don't have any planets yet, for all I know. I mean, you know, but you've got the headquarters in place. All right, you've got the framework all in place. You know, here we can look real quick. I think I'm remembering that correctly, isn't it?
That's
5 billion.
It's not like rebuilding ICE 70 yeah. 15 years.
Yeah, the local system headquarters planets were constructed over a period extending, you know, from that beginning time to about 5 billion years ago. Yeah, so for about 5 billion years, we've had all of the framework in place. Yeah, which, you know, in the scheme of 300 billion years, is not that long ago that the framework has been fully in place, right? So, yeah. So we are that young. You see, again, just pointing to how young we are. Right? Okay.
The Sparanga are the spirit offspring of the bright and morning star and the Father Melchizedek. They are exempt from personality termination, but are not evolutionary or ascending beings. Neither are they functionally concerned with the evolutionary ascension regime. They are the spirit helpers of the local universe, executing the routine spirit tasks of Nebadon.
Okay, so, you know, we've mentioned them a few times because we've been reminding ourselves that, you know, in general, you know, with quote-unquote spirit beings, they aren't procreators. But we have this exception that the Bright Morning Star and Father Melchizedek are so close to being creators, you know, that they are procreators. They procreate Sparanga, and they don't get a lot of discussion in the Revelation, but it's important. You know, you see it right here where they're paired together with the Sparanga. You need basic custodial workers for the worlds, all the architectural worlds. And there's two substances. So there's all the physical things that need to be done. That's done by the Sparanga. And then there's all the spirit substance things that need to be done. That's done by the Sparanga. Okay, so you have... So, you know, whenever you are reading about Sparanga, remember the Sprung are just as much going, you know, doing things at the same time that are related to directly spirit issues. Okay, so, so here's a, you know, this is just that you can see why they needed to reveal this, because once you finally get it drilled into your head that there's two substances, they're just substances, and beings have to deal with, you know, those substances have to be piled up in certain ways or whatever, you know. Right. And so you have to have, logically, two groups of beings that are just dedicated to that enormous task. 647,591 worlds, the smallest of which are as big as the Earth, with no wastelands or oceans or anything. You've got a lot of surface area, you know, that just has countless jobs to do. Making all the substances are where they're supposed to be, you know, and doing what they're supposed to be doing. Huge task. Yeah, you had a question?
Well, yeah, I'll go back to 2 seconds on that.
Okay.
3.8 million worlds approximately.
Oh, yeah, right. Mm-hmm.
Which makes me sort of think that, so Michael finished his seventh pistole about 3/7 of the way through the creation of all the planets in his universe, so to speak. In other words, so, which is kind of an interesting, I never thought about that before. In terms of, he became the master son, I guess.
Yeah.
You know, 3/7 of the way through the creation of, well, maybe not, obviously not the life aspect, but of his universe. All those planets coming in. So for the bulk, or the next 60% of his time, he is now a master son involved with all that.
Yeah.
Which means they don't really have a problem necessarily with rebellion like we did.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, there's all those issues. You know, I can't remember, it was quite a while ago, this issue came up, and we talked a little bit about that, you know, to reflect on just how different an experience the different worlds in a local universe have. You know, that if you were an inhabited world back 200 billion years ago, you know, you get deep into the seventh stage of light and life long before, you know, Michael has even done his first bestowal.
Yeah, that's true.
Right? See, so the whole history of your planet is, you know, very definitively, you know, in a different, you know, environment. You know, and then those worlds, you know, that you're kind of pointing to, you know, their whole process is completely immersed deep into Michael being a master son, you know, and way down the road with that process. And
the truth is different.
All right, all these things, you know, but then there's everything in between, right? So just, you know, to reflect on that, then in order to fill out the Supreme, you've got to have worlds with all these different histories.
We're kind of in the transition.
Right, and we're in the middle, you know, and, right, so, you know, that's to help, you know, to not have that you-centric bias about, you know, the universe, where, you know, only worlds that have gotten, you know, these certain experiences are, you know, could be complete, you know, and we can't imagine how, you know, think about a world, you know, they made it completely to seventh stage of light and life, and they, without their spirit of truth being upstepped, right? So, you know, it's, you don't have to have the kind of spirit of truth that we have. You know, in many ways, we have vast overkill right now, you know, because of the rebellion of the fall. We have so much more ministry than we can even remotely use. Okay, that's why it's so sad to record.
We don't use it.
You know, it's like, you know, you're just completely, you know, drowning in potential, okay, and you do nothing with it, they're saying. I mean, think about a world that has nothing and achieves everything, and you've got everything and are achieving nothing. Okay? All right? Yeah. Quit whining and start doing something. All right? All right?
We prayed like we're isolated.
Right. Right. We're just completely, overwhelmed with more than we could ever use. You know, so if you just use a small fraction of what you've got access to, you can make up for any rebellion, default issue. It's just completely irrelevant. Okay? It's such a tiny measure compared to the measure of potential you have available to you.
Right. But then with the arrival of a magisterial sun, there'll be so much more available.
Yeah, because you don't have it.
Flush out his.
Well, again, I mean, the magisterial son is going to come and say, "So, I'm not going to change anything, Don. You've got all you need. Do something with it."
No, I'm out of here.
You know, yeah.
You can't bury him. You know.
Remember, you know. See, that's part of the lesson. You know, we're constantly looking for that savior to show up. That's going to finally make it so I can do something. You know, if only the master had returned, then I could do something. He's not going to, I mean, anything that he adds is so beyond what you're already using, you won't even notice that he added it. You know, he'll be adding onto the 90th floor. Well, you haven't even used the basement level yet, okay? You're not going to notice that he added the 90th floor. You're not even close to being able to relate to what, you know, he'll bring into play when he comes. Yeah. You know, other than just, you know, what we often need, you know, is a literal visual fact. You know, that's why we have what we just read, you know, a corporeal staff and an Adam and Eve, because we are kind of pitiful by nature, you know, as mortals. You know, we tend to need that crutch of a visual thing, a tangible thing. You know, you can go up and touch Adam and Eve. Oh, okay, I guess I you know, my belief is not, you know, in, you know, foolishness. Right? I know we have records. These beings have been here for thousands of years, you know, and I mean, it keeps us, you know, reminding. But, you know, we're supposed to be agendanters.
Right.
Does that come those to who end? Do without seeing. Okay?
Does that all come to an end when we get a...
Well, yeah, that's one of the things that always comes up. How does that work with that whole agendanter thing when you actually can see again? You know, I don't know. Will you no longer sit at the right hand of the master? Will my place of preference not be there anymore?
Your angels are probably still giving you big speed.
Okay. All right. So the kind of the unsung in the background, guys, because we have so immediate a relation with spirit substance, the Sporanga, now the ones that are much more immediate to us here.
The Spornasia. Spornasia?
Whichever way you'd like.
Spornasia. Thank you. The architectural headquarters worlds of the local universe are real worlds, physical creations. There is much work connected with their physical upkeep, and herein we have the assistance of a group of physical creatures called Spornasia. They are devoted to the care and culture of the material phases of these headquarters worlds, from Gerasim to Salvington. Spornasia are neither spirits nor persons. They are an animal order of existence, but if you could see them, you would agree that they seem to be perfect animals.
Okay, so again, you know, here's just this little teaser. You know, we all know, you know, when we get to the local systems, you know, we get a lot more on them. But let's just, you know, notice definitively what they've put in here, like that last part. So, you know, this will be an interesting thing for all of us to finally appreciate what's the difference between me as merely a fancy animal, just an animal origin creature, and me as a human. It's very hard for us to figure this out right now. You know, all we can basically suspect is that most of the time we're probably calling what's actually just fancy animal personal doings. You know, I think I'm using my will when really I'm just asserting myself. And things like this. I'm doing something spiritual and really I'm just doing something mindful. When you finally can see these, so where you max out the full fancy animal and you can see it in front of you, then finally it's like, oh, wow, my whole mortal life wasn't even that profound. I wasn't, boy, yeah, right. I mean, that's when it'll really sink home when you see them You know, and you all know if you read about it. I mean, they do a lot of things that, you know, sounds like that ought to be a person doing that, you know. No, see, so they'll be a very straightforward touchstone on this issue of, you know, you'll think you're pretty fancy with your Marantia body and everything, you know, and the mere animals, not persons, are running circles around you. Okay. Like, okay, I'm going to have to take it up a notch here. The non-personal gardeners are making me look pretty minimal here. All right, so it'll be a nice little dose of humility and context about what that difference between very profound mindful activity and actual personal activity. I would guess that, you know, that's one of the sort of the indirect, very indispensable roles that they play in the universe. Is, you know, lesson A on the first mansion world, for you to just notice them, and in comparison to you, and get yourself to tame down the self-aggrandizement a little bit, and to patiently try to start working on some of the rudimentary processes, you know, of,
you know, I always said that's the first thing I want to see.
At least being as profoundly mental as they are, and then see if you can build upon that. Right.
Think
so.
Will be as affectionate. I mean, will they be affectionate like animals?
Oh, yeah. Sure. They're going to be so much more affectionate than any animal can imagine being.
Oh yeah.
Way beyond any animal can be affectionate. They have the full. They have the full five adjutant mind activity.
Are they on the
They're on all. They're on both the Spurunga and the Spurnaja are on all the architectural worlds, from the first one to the last one, the whole spectrum. Yeah.
What did you say about the five adjutants?
Okay, so the Spurnaja, you know, have they're just an animal, so they have just the first five adjutants. Okay.
But wait, the five adjutants are only functioning on the evolutionary worlds.
No, functioning everywhere in the local universe.
Okay, I'm gonna have to find that passage.
I mean, again, you know, remember, it's. I mean, how could Adam and how could the material sons and daughters on a local system headquarters have mind if there wasn't adjutant mind there? They have adjutant mind. Material sons and daughters have adjutant mind, just like you do. They're making more of it than I am,
yeah.
Or you are, but it's the same seven adjutants.
Material sons and
yeah.
So they just don't have the last. They don't have the last two.
Right.
They don't have worship and wisdom.
They can't know God.
Okay. They can't know God. They can't worship. Right. But it's not mentioned here.
Can reincarnate too.
Right. Right. Again.
They
well, they
have a chance to become.
It's not that they can reincarnate. They are reincarnated. Yeah. I mean. Okay.
And they're the only ones that may have a chance to progress and become
right. Right. I was just going to point out that if you read about them about the local systems, they not only have the five adjutants fully. So there's another fact that comes into play. Once you max out the five adjutants, there's a super additive consequence. They tell you they have an effective additional sixth phase of mind. Sort of a holistic phase of those five, a super additive consequence of those five that's only possible when you max them out. You know, so no normal, you know, mortal animal does that. But they do, you know, and that's what gives them a quasi-personal-like nature, an encompassing-like nature, that they have this sixth phase that sort of encompasses the five. Okay. And so that wholeness is what is you know, what makes them so profound. And that, again, it's just, that'll be a very important contrasting lesson for us, you know, to see if you really have, you know, any definitive wholeness going on because you're encompassing your mind activity with your personality. You know, look at what kind of mind activity, the holistic mind activity this creature has, and it doesn't have a personality to sort of, you know, forcibly, you might say, encompass, you know. It just naturally gets encompassed super additively, and they manifest a holistic behavior that you never saw on your all your life on your mortal sphere.
And you can't speak to them.
like maybe right. courage or something like that.
Or things that we don't even really have words for, right? See, some of these holistic things that are so that so don't manifest on our world, we don't even have words in the dictionary for them because no one's ever seen them, right? They're animals that were designed and you know, put together by the life carriers.
Someone said, "Can my dog graduate to a Speron?"
No. The law of identity makes dogs separate from Spornaja. Okay, so.
Charlie, my little Shih Tzu dog, he is so loyal. You know, he jumps on me all the time, wants to be with me all the time, follows me everywhere. So these Spornasias, since they are animal creatures, and you said they're very, very loving,
right.
Or you know,
but they're also very dutiful. You know, so you know they're not just wandering around; they're all very tasked. You know, very busy. So you know, it's not you know they're just not here, there, and everywhere. But if you go up and engage them. They have all the time in the world, so you know they'll put down their shovel and you know and interact with you, and they're not like you know master physical controllers or something, you know, or you walk up and they just sublimely ignore you, you know, and are about their business, you know.
Frankly, yeah.
But
yeah. But I mean, could they be like companions?
Well, you got to understand, busy. I mean, they may be just look like you. They could be they're not an animal, but it doesn't mean they don't have hands and legs and everything.
I like
you
them
don't
too.
Know.
Again, we don't know. I mean, you know, it just opens up a whole area of speculation. You could wonder, well, how much interaction am I going to have with him?
I mean, we'd have to have a lot, because why would they create them down here, animals down here, for us not to be able to interact with them in that kind of a way up there? They, you know?
Right. Again, see, that's what I say. You could speculate that the kind of interaction we have with animals down here might be a downstep expression of the interaction up there. But, you know, you're just going to have to keep it in context. Remember, none of us can even remotely imagine the environment there. The Reveteurs tell you that any attempt you make in your wildest dreams to even imagine what the living conditions are on even the first mansion world will be at best grotesque. Okay, we can't even remotely comprehend what this, you know, interaction would be. It's be completely beyond our understanding. Okay, so that, but the fact that they're just an animal and material, that should remind you again what we were saying earlier. There's possibilities for material phenomena. It's not even personal. Doesn't even have the sixth and seventh adjectives. This beyond our imagination right now. Completely beyond. I mean, the Revelators say they can't even, you know, not even with their perspective, can they say something clever that wouldn't be grotesque. We are completely incapable of even remotely understanding what we're talking about here. Okay? All we know are things like you're saying, that in some very sublime, amazing way, what we experience is a downstepped expression of that. But you know, keep the orientation. You experience a shadow. That's the substance, right? Okay. Not this is the substance, and that's an exalted expression of this substance. That's the incorrect way to think about it.
Yeah.
Don't extrapolate up. Try to appreciate that it's coming top down, and you live in a two-dimensional, shadowy, experiential world. Okay. All right. Let's see. So, what else do we have here? I guess that we pretty much covered that. Other than not, like I was saying, you know, they definitively stress there is much work connected with their physical upkeep. You know, the architectural worlds. Just even though I didn't say it, there's just as much work, the spirit substance upkeep, and that's what the Speranga are for. Okay.
The various courtesy colonies are domiciled on Salvington and elsewhere. We especially profit from the ministry of the celestial artisans on the constellations and benefit from the activities of the reversion directors, who operate chiefly on the capitals of the local systems.
Okay, everyone remember when we did courtesy colonies back in paper 30, the latter part of paper 30? You know, they just, you know, it should remind you that, remember, two of those colonies are the celestial artisans and the reversion directors. The ascending mortals are always one of the courtesy colonies as well, and that's why they're about to mention them. But you can go back and remind yourself of those various courtesy colonies, and that, you know, again, you know, what you can do in passing on a particular architectural world is indispensable. Certain things need to be done there, and coincidentally, there's these beings that are passing through, these pilgrims, you know, that's why they call us pilgrims so much, ascending pilgrims, is because we're foreigners that are, you know, just passing through. But, you know, if there weren't those pilgrims, certain things couldn't get done. You know, so every level you're at, there will be things to do. You know, you'll have, you know, tasks in front of you because the whole universe is depending upon you to do that task. You're the only being in the universe that can do that task. Yeah. All right, so, all right, you're always indispensable.
You can't do it, no one.
I mean, again, that's because it's a cosmic system. To again ingrain that in your thinking, you know, when it seems like you're worthless, you know, no one cares. No, we are indispensable at every level. Only beings like you can do certain tasks, and you do them, and you'll do them well. And the higher you go, the more the word well goes up. Yeah, you know? But you'll still be doing well. It'll just be weller. Yep, than before. All right? All right? Okay, so that's, you know, make sure there's a lot of facts here. Don't just treat them factually. Think about the truth of what's going on here. Understand how you're part of this cosmic system, what it means. Okay, so here you are on a certain architectural world in a certain courtesy colony, and what are you up to?
Always there is attached to the universe service a core of ascending mortals, including the glorified midway creatures. These ascenders, after attaining Salvington, are used in an almost endless variety of activities in the conduct of universe affairs. From each level of achievement, these advancing mortals reach back and down to extend a helping hand to their fellows who follow them in the upward climb. Such mortals of temporary sojourn on Salvington are assigned on requisition to practically all cores of celestial personalities as helpers, students, observers, and teachers.
Okay, so now there's a little bit of information relative to what I was just saying. Notice that there is a limit to how much you can do. Until you have ascended up to a local universe headquarters level. You know, and then things, from then on, you know, it gets to be quite significant in terms of really, you know, jumping in and working with all the different countless beings in the universe and what they're up to, like they're describing at the end there. But nonetheless, even on the first mansion world, you know, it won't just be you, the student. It will also be, to some degree, maybe small initially, but you as part of the ministry and administration, right, of the cosmic system. But it is interesting that it doesn't become a really significant thing until you get to the local universe headquarters, and that's. So, in other words, I have a lot of internalizing to do first before there's a lot that I can put out. Yeah. But, remember, you know, it's a level of perfection. So once you're perfected to that level, now you can, you're perfectly, you know, useful in all these things, and then you get assigned all over the place doing all kinds of things. Okay? You know, that because you need a perfect being to do that, at least at that level of relative perfection. Yeah, so that's the main reason. See, and again, that's how it fits into what we've just been reading about. You know, so immediately. Right, there's, yep.
All this stuff that you have to do, mm-hmm. I imagine that it wouldn't be work, maybe you'd like to do it. Now it's kind of work, but...
Right. Yeah. Yeah, see, and that's that goes hand in hand with what I was just saying about, they tell you, you can't even remotely imagine specifically what we're talking about here. And so, keep that in mind. When you think about, okay, I'm trying to imagine this, and it sounds like work... Okay, remember, your imagination cannot serve you at all. So everything your imagination imagines is false. Right? So if it sounds like a work, say no.
Joyous.
No. It's going to be, you know, it's going to be delightful in a way that you can't even imagine right now. That's, you know, the mystery of that. Just let the mystery be. Stop trying to somehow speculate up, you know, and falsify the object, as they say, like speculation always does, right? Just know that, you know, it will be so sublimely satisfying that it's beyond your imagination. And yet, somehow, you know that it's very active and task-oriented. So it has all that precision, and yet the unity that's so satisfying at the same time, you know? And we don't have the imagination to imagine the unity. See, so all we see is the individuality, and it sounds like drudgery.
Right.
Because it's devoid of the satisfaction of the unity, because it's beyond our imagination right now.
Which it is here.
But there it will be just so amazing. You just got to hold on to that. When it, at times when the revelation seems to sound kind of heavy and ominous, you know, what you're moving into as you go up, you know, with all these statements about law and things like this, and it sounds like you're being nailed down, you know, and your liberty is being taken away. And again, remember, that's because your imagination is completely inadequate to the task, and that's why it doesn't sound exciting to you, you know. So just, you know, recognize that your opinions and thoughts about these things are irrelevant. They just, you know, they have nothing to do with it. So just forget about it. Just try to just be present with the joy that you know it will be. There was some, oh, here, yeah.
When I'm working on a task here that's really something that I'm good at, and that's really suitable for me, I think it's kind of fun mm-hmm. to be working on something. I mean, it's enjoyable. Some people might look at it and go, oh, that's work, but for me, it's a good thing. But as we express our personalities more and more as we go on, things that are suitable for us, things that we really just, you know, like doing because for us particular, that's something we're good at and it's our thing. And as we do that more and more at higher and higher levels, and we express our personality more and more and become what we're becoming, who we're becoming, that sounds really exciting.
Yeah, maybe just one other thing that occurred to me as you were saying that, you know, to add to what I was saying before is, you know, again, the fact that they tell you you can't even imagine just a little bit higher level of unity so that this could sound exciting to you. Again, that's how little you can manifest personality. You know, that pattern, that spirit pattern, you know. I mean, that's how, the fact that I can't even manifest enough personality in this life to imagine the, you know, immediately next life, that's how limited personally I am, okay? Now, as soon as I'm more personal, I might be able to see spirit substance, for instance, because it's spirit pattern, you know. Again, why can't I see any spirit beings that might happen to be nearby? Because I'm not even remotely personal enough. I don't have a remotely enough relationship to spirit substance yet.
No, because you take off your glasses,
yeah.
You can't even see.
Right? Again, it all just it all goes hand in hand, you know, just appreciating, you know, being comfortable with your limitation. Be satisfied to be one of the Alpheus twins, because when all is said and done, that's all any of us can be, okay, in this life. There's just no ability to be very profound. So do what you're supposed to do at this level. Knowing that the Spurnaja are looking at you and thinking, really, that's all you can muster? You're so much more you could do even without your personality that you aren't doing. You know, just the level of mind that you're not using. You don't even know what you can do with your fifth adjutant. You know, they could teach you so many things about what you could do with your fifth adjutant that you've never even imagined. Right? And they're an animal. Right? So, just that humility, you walk into your classroom and your teacher is an animal on the first Manjin world. hello class. This is 101. First we're going to teach you to bark, okay, and then we're going to teach you to roll over. I mean, you got a lot of work to do here. We're not going to fetch just yet. Fetching is a little beyond you yet, okay?
Service, service, and more service. And, there's something about you can understand the spirit of what they're talking about. When you serve someone else and the joy that you get out of doing that, the spirit that you feel from that is the same kind of spirit feeling that you will probably get. And it'll be something that you'll want to do because of the way that you can feel that now a little bit here on Earth when you do something like that for people, how it makes you feel. So that's, and that's going to be more and more and more of that from here on out.
Yeah, wait till you literally have senses that can sense spirit substance. Think of the feeling you'll get when you're in relationship with spirit substance. It will be a direct feeling instead of the indirect one we get now, which can be quite profound.
Yeah.
Can be very motivating and sustaining. And it's, downstepped 95 times. It's so indirect and remote. Wait until you get a direct feedback that you're engaging unity. I mean, it will be so delightful,
The whole concept of heaven that's out amongst, our fellows, I mean, heaven, it's sort of all bliss and laid back. I'd be on drugs in a month. I would be so bored. It's nothing like we can imagine.
All right, so... So the courtesy colony that will be you one day is an ascending mortal, doing lots and lots of things. You'll be way beyond boredom. Only animals get bored, remember. So as soon as you leave animal behind, the word bored gets left behind. All right, so let's see what else they have to say here.
There are still other types of intelligent life concerned with the administration of a local universe, but the plan of this narrative does not provide for the further revelation of these orders of creation. Enough of the life and administration of this universe is being herewith portrayed to afford the mortal mind a grasp of the reality and grandeur of the survival existence. Further experience in your advancing careers will increasingly reveal these interesting and charming beings. This narrative cannot be more than a brief outline of the nature and work of the manifold personalities who throng the universes of space, administering these creations as enormous training schools, schools wherein the pilgrims of time advance from life to life, and from world to world until they are lovingly dispatched from the borders of the universe of their origin to the higher educational regime of the super universe, and thence on to the spirit training worlds of Havona, and eventually to paradise and the high destiny of the finaliters. The eternal assignment on missions not yet revealed to the universes of time and space.
Long sentence.
Dictated by a brilliant evening star of Nebadon, number 1146 of the created core.
Okay, let's just touch upon a few of the little things that are amidst all that poetic sweep there. right at the very beginning, but the plan of this narrative. You know, we've spoken to this a couple times. Okay, so you take this slice through the total universe of things and beings, and you get what we have here, this complete package, where everything has this holistic arrangement. You know, the word plan. Okay. You know, the details and the whole, you know, that the word plan implies. I see, so just like I was saying, you when you do that slice and have what we have in front of us here, you have this quote unquote plan. And you can see him referring to just what we were talking about quite a bit there, that whole bit about we've given you really all that we can say that has some relationship to what's going on, you know, in the higher lives. I mean, in some ways they're limited by some definitive, you know, mandate in the revelation mandate. In other cases, it's just a practical limitation, you know, that we were describing. There's in many ways there's almost nothing that they can say that we have about those worlds that we could comprehend. And if they tried to, it would be such a distortion that it would do more harm than good for them to say it. You would so have such a twisted picture. They're stressing that, but reminding you that try to just grasp what you can and know that you're grasping the reality and grandeur of the survival existence. It is real, it's grand. And if nothing else, you know, hold on to that firmly and don't let anything else that you might read diminish that. You know, if it sounds like it's not so grand, know that you're misinterpreting what you're reading. It's by definition grand. And then just try to somehow, you know, grok the details that you can't quite seem to keep in that grand picture, you know. That's the challenge, to not lose hold of it. You know, we've been going through the book so far here from the beginning, and it's come up many times where what we're reading is sounding kind of gloomy and heavy and not grand, you know. And you have to hold on to that. Don't let that, you know, cloud your relationship to your future. Let's see. What else did we have there? We had, enormous training schools. That, of course, is, you know, hearkening back to the entire universe as one vast school line. Right. See, so they're stressing that again. There's the pilgrims, like we were saying. You kind of get it right there at the end. You're getting into the poetry, and then they use the word regime. You know, it's like pokes an awl into the balloon, you know. regime is such a heavy word. The higher educational regime. To try to somehow not, you know, envision, you know, jackboots, you know, in the midst of such a word. You know, that's the challenge. Right, that's the challenge, you know, to not diminish the grandeur at the same time that you have a harsh word like regime right there. It's a form word. They're trying to, yeah, you know, right, it's, you know, it, the higher you go, the more rigorous the form is, but the more liberating that is what we can't imagine right now. That's, our imagination can't combine liberty with rigidity. Right.
When there's a little kid, if there's more form in their life, they know more about what to expect, and you tend to get a more confident child.
Right. We do have some ways that we can appreciate this, like you're pointing out.
Otherwise it's chaos.
What a parent recognizes about, you know, the necessity of form for a child, and You know, and as a society, we're doing a grand experiment to see what it's like if you give kids no form and then let them grow up to be adults, or so-called. Well, of course, they don't grow up to be adults, and civilization collapses. All right, so form is indispensable. I mean, that's why this book is in my lap, that those sorts of emergency situations, you know, that we haven't, you know, don't have enough form, and we're about to go literally formless and lose. I mean, civilization is chosen form, and there's no one choosing form anymore. We think form is evil, an offense to my liberty. It's like, well, you're going to get chaos then. You're going to lose your civilization, and you're going to be groping around hungry and afraid again. Spooky. You know, and you're not going to like it. You might decide that form has a place again, all right? Okay, right at the end there is a little reminder again of a definitive revelatory limitation. The high destiny of the finaliters, and then parenthetically, the eternal assignment on missions not yet revealed to the universes of time and space. They're not allowed to say much about what happens in the second half of your finite career when you're a finaliter. But again, I mean, you know, if they said something, what would it, you know, how could I understand it anyway, right? I mean, if I can't even understand the first mansion world. Right. Okay. So, but nonetheless, you know, we all know that, you know, when you're searching around trying to figure out exactly what you do as a finality, and you're just not going to find it because it's outside of the boundaries of revelation. Okay. And then the last little bit there, let me wrap it up here. We've talked about this a couple times. You know, the little byline at the end of the paper about the author. This is an interesting one. This one is quote-unquote dictated. Okay, it doesn't say that anywhere else. This is the one that literally says dictated. To remind you, I mentioned this when it came up a week or two ago, that when you have a being like a brilliant evening star, okay, there is no divide separating that brilliant evening star from the secondary midwayer that needs to actually, you know, write something down on a piece of paper, okay, to hand to the contact commission. Okay, I mean, he's literally just dictating it to the secondary midwayer. He's speaking, and the secondary midwayer is listening and writing it down. Okay, it's just, you know, very straightforward process when you're dealing with the...
Wasn't the stenographer.
right. There's no, you know, no humans are involved, no contact personalities involved, no adjusters and all that mystery and all that sort of stuff. I mean, it's, right, this is all just very, just, you know, two beings sitting in a room and one being is dictating the paper to the other, okay? It's as straightforward as that, you know, so... They try to, you know, they know that we're all going to want to go all mystical and, you know, off in la-la land with, you know, how this book came into existence. They try to occasionally remind you, no, it's pretty straightforward, you know. They just talk to each other, okay? The other little thing is, I don't know why they say 1,146. That's pretty curious that they give you the number. But it does remind you, remember when we did the Brilliant Evening Stars, there at the beginning of paper 37, that, remember, there's both the ones that are created as Brilliant Evening Stars and the ones that ascend to that role, okay, and all together, there's not very many of them, and the created ones, there's only 4,832 of them. So, that little number does remind you of that. In the grand scheme of things, every time a brilliant evening star has engaged this world, like it's time you're about your father's business, or, you know, the angel of the Lord, quote unquote, sometimes in the Old Testament stories, or right here, you know, this is a pretty select thing to be engaged by one. You know, 1,146 out of 4,832. You know, it's a lot like those limited prints of a piece of art. you know, and they purposely put, you know, so many out of so many to remind you of how special it is, you know, that you have print number 55 out of 70 or something, right? That's part of what is going on there, is just like you put down in the corner of a print of a piece of art, you know, that limited edition sort of thing to remind you of, you know, there's a lot of tasks in a local universe, you know, and a being that's very, very busy took a big chunk of his time to literally come here, and all the time it took to get here, and to sit down and dictate a paper.
You had to learn English first.
Right, has to know English, has to speak it, you know. And so he's sitting there, he's saying, besides the seraphic and mortal orders, and the secondary midwayer is writing that down, to appreciate what this being did for you, you know, very high being, you know, went through a lot of very specific labor just for you. Okay, so.
It also tells you about the process.
It tells you about
what you're saying.
Yeah, and then, like I said, I mean that, right? You know, don't you know? I mean, the bylines have importance too. You know, that's why I'm often, you know, holding them up and getting you to reflect on them a little bit. You know, and noticing how they're expressed and whether or not, you know, you notice another thing we could go here. It's like, well, I don't know. I mean, is this one on the one of the 12 that's in the Revelatory Commission? Or did he just get assigned? It's not, you know, no direct indication. He may not be one of the 12 again. And maybe like that Verondadek, you know, that was assigned the task. So, just to take some time to reflect on even little details like that and see what it says. All right. Well, we're perfectly on time here. So next time we will, we've been building up to this. We have all these beings that don't have as huge a role in our ascension career that we've been going through methodically, you know, getting them in place. But, you know, now we're going to do the seraphim. Yeah. So now we have the very, very relevant to our ascension career beings that are going to get tons and tons and tons of information on you know, what is basically been called angels, you know, all throughout history, the seraphim. So that's what we'll start next time. Let's take a moment here.